Hi, I'm Anne Strangehamps. It's to the best of our knowledge, and if you're one of the millions of people watching the Rio Olympics, then you've seen some performances that look practically superhuman. Michael Phelps, Simone Biles, Usain Bolt. When you watch these people and you think, today's athletes are just better, faster, stronger than anyone else who ever came before. But maybe that's not quite fair.
Jesse Owens ran on a track made of cinders. He didn't have starting blocks. They would dig holes to put their feet in at the start. It's not hard to imagine that Jesse Owens would have run much faster than he did in 1936 today, that maybe he would have been as fast as Usain Bolt is today if he'd had the advantages that Bolt had, where billions of people around the world will see him run live in real time on a track surface engineered for speed, using cleats that have been designed for his unique biomechanics as he runs, with a training regimen that's been planned down to the day on how to get the absolute peak performance in that one moment.
This is Wired Magazine's Mark McCleskey. He's the author of Faster, Higher, Stronger, The New Science of Creating Super Athletes. And he argues that the kind of peak performances we see today are not necessarily because athletes are better, but because science and technology are.
I'm saying that, yeah, I'm saying that a huge factor in how athletes are able to perform at these different levels is through science and technology. Things like interval training, which is a concept that even most recreational athletes are familiar with, right? That instead of like you just go out and sort of like do a run or a bike ride, like how about you go out and go slowly and then have like really hard efforts from time to time, mm-hmm. that you overload those physiological systems and they sort of adapt to that workload and become stronger. That was a concept that had barely been explored in the 1930s. It really originated in Finland, and that's how sort of Finnish runners in the 20s and 30s into the 40s were world-dominant middle-distance runners. They were the only people training this way, which turns out to be an incredibly effective way to train. But that was unknown. That was a new concept in the world.
What goes into achieving world-class performance today, if you look at the Olympic sprinters and runners that we'll be watching next week?
It's an unbelievable sort of support system and structure of exercise physiologists and biomechanists and nutritionists and sports psychologists and, you know, people to manage sponsorships and the financial support to do it. We have this romantic notion of sort of like an athlete and a coach like go and isolate themselves and are able to reach the pinnacle. And while it's still possible, it's really unlikely that the sort of structure that you need to bring all of these specialties to bear onto an athlete's performance is pretty vast. It's a lot. And when you're dealing with a performance environment where the difference between winning an Olympic gold medal and being one of the most famous people on the planet and finishing fourth and nobody ever hears of you again is measured in hundredths of a second, sometimes thousandths of a second in some event. And so those little tiny gains, that's sort of what every athlete is looking for, and they're looking for it through any vector that they can possibly find.
Mm. The thing I never understand that always puzzles me is there was a long period of time when people wondered if it was even possible for a human being to run a 4-minute mile, you know, and then Roger Bannister did. And then after that, I mean, now high school athletes do it. So performance has to be more than just, you know, better tracks, better running shoes, great science. There's something else.
Oh, the mind is, that's the frontier here, is really understanding what happens in the mind. I mean, you talk about Roger Bannister, you know, he was not the only person trying to break the 4-minute mile. And people came close and started to talk about a barrier, right? And then he does it, and suddenly, like, three people do it in the next 6 months.
So do you think that'll happen with the 2-hour marathon?
Perhaps. You know, I think the two-hour marathon is right at the very outer limits of our understanding of human physiology today.
So there are limits. There are limits to human physiology.
So I did phrase that carefully. It's right at the boundaries of our understanding of human physiology today. So the things I want to point there are our understanding and today. So when we talk about the mind, there's a lot of really interesting research about what is fatigue. Is fatigue a physical thing that happens in our muscles? That's been the sort of dominant understanding of fatigue for most of the history of exercise physiology. But you know, this idea like I'm lifting a weight, I'm doing curls, and then my muscle just says like, nope, no more. Like the muscle is out of something or has some sort of waste product in it or has been limited at the muscular level from doing any more work. When you start to look at that person in a lab, you find out that at that moment of like, I cannot budge this weight, only 40% of the fibers in that muscle are contracting.
Wow.
So why is that? Yeah. Why are we only using 40% of that muscle? What's controlling that?
And what would give you access to the other 60%?
Exactly. So broadly, the theory has come to be known as the central governor theory, and it's this idea that fatigue is an emotion, does not exist at the muscular level, but exists at the central level, at the sort of, let's call it the mind, but it could be more complicated than that. You know, the argument for the main central governor theory is that our mind is constantly calculating how much further we have to go, how much effort it's going to take to get there, how we're feeling, the feedback the body is giving the brain, and it's constantly balancing all of this.
The other thing that I took away from your book is the idea of approaching your own performance, whether it's in sports or life, I guess, as an experiment.
I'm glad you took that away. That I would say that's sort of my other thing is record data. Like, even if it's like, did I wake up happy today? Right? Like, if you start to know things that feed into your happiness, like, you can start to affect it. If you start to see, like, oh, I'm running a little bit faster when I do this, then you can double down on it. But if you aren't capturing that information, you're just sort of groping for things without being able to measure any effects. Like, Peter Drucker has that the famous sort of business line, you know, what gets measured gets managed. And that's true. So, you know, whatever it is you're trying to do, change is hard. Like, improvement is hard. Changing things in our life is difficult. But if you aren't keeping track of it, if you aren't viewing it as an experiment, it's very difficult to know where you've started from and where you've gotten to.
Become a scientist of your own life.
Yes.
Thanks so much, Mark. It was fun talking.
Thank you.
Mark McCluskey is the editor of Wired.com and author of Faster, Higher, Stronger, The New Science of Creating Super Athletes and How You Can Train Like Them.